the moon. Let's go on the moon. This thing is cool. I'm your freakiest. Play the room, say you're all freakiest. That's what I'm going to do. I know all the good shit's in there, but I'm going to go. I love it, love it, but it's a bit. So I ain't going to
finished with the Jay Giles Band, the 45 of Centerfold, spun backwards. And before that, it was Rangers, new music on Not Not Fun. Great pop, sounds like Philadelphia. Pan Am Stories, name of the CD. Song we heard, Sacred Cows. That was preceded by Bronze, lovely new LP called Copper. Track we heard, A Showdown of Sorts. Tom Cameron from 1982's Music to Wash Dishes By, going out to Chris M, who we heard on the radio last night, filling in for Martha. Great to hear Chris on the radio. Zoot, the name of the track from Tom Cameron's Music to Wash Dishes By. Kuhn before that. The CD is called Random Patterns. It is solo organ material. We heard about 4 minute excerpt of the opening cut called Armand Dates Pattern. And we open that set with music from Nesguo Hat, side project of Tom Homan, I believe is his name, from USA is a Monster, Black Elf Speaks, and others. It's a 7-inch called From the Sky. We heard a track entitled Watch the Skies. That's everything we heard. My name is Scott. I'll see ya next Monday, same time. Stay tuned. Next up, Benjamin Walker's Too Much Information coming right up. And this is Freeform Radio, WFMU in East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, worldwide, WFMU.org. Bye-bye.
There's this painting that I keep with me, always. It's one of those little postcard reproductions. I've even made a gold frame for it out of balsa wood. The painting is called The Artist in His Studio. It's by John Singer Sargent. I've brought it with me here to the studio. I have it right here in front of me, propped up next to the microphone. The painting depicts a man painting a picture in his studio. But this artist's studio is not an ordinary studio. It is the artist's home. The man has his painting propped up on the bed and the bureau. There is no easel. You get the idea that the only things in the room are the bed, the bureau, and the chair upon which the man sits. The man is confined to extremely small quarters. The setting is grim, and it contrasts with the painting that the man is working on. A landscape. The man is painting a landscape. Horses meander through a soft green meadow, and the trees are lush and full, and the blue horizon is dotted with clouds. Most Sargent commentators dismiss this painting. They consider it to be nothing but a silly joke, an artist painting a landscape in his cramped, doleful bedroom. But I consider this painting to be a masterpiece, because it captures the idea that through art, man is able to transcend his dismal, squalid surroundings. This painting is not a joke. This artist is not painting a landscape. This artist is painting a window. Look out this window for a moment. Here, let me move out of your way. You'll find the view is breathtaking. I've spent my entire life looking for the way to get to the other side of this window. I've been told time and time again that I'm wasting my efforts, but I've never given up. I've always known that there is a way to break the glass and crawl out over the windowsill. I've always been certain of it, and I made a vow that I would never give up until I discovered the secret. You're snickering at me. Well, go ahead and laugh. You think I'm crazy for believing that there's something on the other side of this window. Well, I'm not. The reality on the other side is just as real as the one we stand in right now. Sometimes I think it's even more real. But we do not have to go into that now. I have not brought you here to this window to discuss the metaphysics of reality. I have brought you here to this window because I need your help. You see, I believe that I have finally discovered the secret. So I'm going to go to the other side of the studio now, and I need you to kneel down here in the front. I'm going to count to three. And on three, I'm going to run towards you, and you are going to lift me into the air. You are going to catapult me through the window. Trust me, this is going to work. With your help, I am going to break the glass and land on the other side. So, on three. One. Two. Three. We'll be right back.
hiding out here in my work home studio. I live and work in the same place. My studio is my home. My home is my studio. I'm living between my couch and my computer. So, I was reading the newspaper online and I kind of got sucked into signing up on a dating site. It was so well done. It sounded great, you know, and I just kind of I wanted to find out more. So I sign up and, you know, it seems like people are interested in you without having, you haven't really done anything. You have like a whole list of guys waiting for you. And so of course, I sign up, I pay the fee, and it's fascinating for, you know, a couple days. I want to participate. I want to do it. I'm about to find the right man, you know, so I'm going to do this right now. I'm going to put pictures up, you know, I'm going to respond and all that. And so I do. And then the matching points. Oh my God. So the matching points were, that was the thing that kind of got me. There was one person who had like really high matching points with me. And it turns out he's an event manager. And his slogan was, "I'm standing solid in the air with my feet." And I was like, wow, if that's what he really means, that sounds good. And so, you know, I just wrote to him and said, well, you know, that I liked his slogan and all that, and that we have high matching points and stuff. Things pick up. And then, of course, somehow, I don't know, I had to pull out. It's like, this is too intense. And, you know, everything, all these things started to sound a little too intense. It seems like seems a little complicated to do all this, you know, in advance. I mean, at the end you're gonna meet up at a bar, right? So I finally decided to go out to a bar. In Zurich, they have open studios once a year, first on one side of the river and then on the second side. And so I was invited to one of these open studios, and I went to have a cocktail at the bar of my friends, and I didn't know anybody. Went in there with my dog, had a cocktail or two, and somebody starts to talk to me, and he looks like he had a couple drinks too many already.
So you like this guy even though he was drunk? I didn't ruin that for you. That's good to know. It's good to know you still have the hots for the drunk guy.
Well, I don't know. No, he was the only guy who talked to me, so, and I wasn't gonna talk to anybody, so what else am I gonna do? He kind of looked at me in a way, he kind of had this look on his face, which I was very uncertain if this is now, you know, what kind of look is this? Is this the look he has when he picks up anybody? Is this how I am interpreting his look? You know, it's basically, I was just happy that I had met somebody I had never met. And actually, I was grateful that this person spoke to me, because I wouldn't have spoken to him. I don't walk up to strangers. I'm not the kind of person who just starts to talk to a stranger. As I'm on my way out, I do think to myself, oh well, maybe I should have asked him for his number. You know, maybe there's something to him, despite he's being drunk. Maybe he's there for the same reason as me. Who knows? People do meet at bars. After I was at that bar, I decided to go to the bookstore because I'm in the process of catching up on various things, such as art history. And so I want to go to the bookstore and find out which are the books that they are using at school. And I'm not going to buy it because I'm going to go to the library and to save the money. And so I go to the bookstore, the art department, and here stands the guy from the bar. And it's actually, this time it's actually me saying hi to him. And of course, like, between the books, for some reason, like, he doesn't even recognize me. That's the funniest, you know? So at the bar, he has this kind of sleazy look on his face, and then in the bookstore he's like, you know, I just seem to blend in between the books or something. And so we talk, and of course he actually has that book that I'm looking for, so we go and have a coffee. He tells me that he has the book, but it's at his brother's and he needs to get it back because his brother's not reading the book, but he will do that, and you know that I can come pick it up. And I already have something in mind, something more than just picking up the book, because I actually need more books. And so I'm actually psyched to kind of go check out his place and see what's gonna, you know, what's up there. You know, does he have a library? Because that's actually what I need. You know, so but I'm not gonna present that idea yet. I'm gonna go and pick up that book, and then I'm gonna, you know, see what's next. You know, something's happening, and I'm just psyched that something's happening. So, you know, it takes him a couple days to actually have the book and be, you know, have time to hand it over. And he only texts me, you know. It's so he's like, okay, the book is ready. You can come pick it up. When are you going to come? And so I'm about to go and pick up the book at the other end of the city.
I don't understand. I don't understand why you're totally cool with hooking up with some drunk guy from the bar, but you can't even meet the guy from the internet who has the matching points and the philosophy of living in the sky with his feet in the air.
Well, it's quite simple, because, I mean, here's the answer. This guy with the books, he actually doesn't even have internet. So I would certainly not find him on the internet. So it kind of confirms that I wouldn't meet this kind of guy on the internet. And you know, that sounds good. That sounds good to me.
Amy Pearl is a Brooklyn dog lover, and one day, someone sent her a funny dog link.
EternalEarthboundPets.com. It's like, you help Christians. I don't really care about Christians, but I do care about animals. And you help them because when they go to the rapture, they need someone to take care of their pets, and this site helps hook them up with people who aren't going to go to heaven, who will come and get their pets. And I was like, I could do this. I could. And so I posted something on Urban Hound so that Christians in the New York area with pets would look at it and find me, and they did. There are a lot of born-agains in New York City, and you know, it's weird, especially like Williamsburg and Bay Ridge.
Tonight, we're on our way to visit Laura, a young woman who recently emailed Amy about her dog, Cola.
All right, let's... She said buzzer five.
Hello?
Hi, Laura. It's Amy to meet Cola.
Okay, I'll buzz you up.
Hello?
Hi.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh.
She's very nice.
Oh, she's nice.
Well, do you want to take her on a walk and then we can talk about...
That would be great.
Yeah. Okay. So let me just get her leash on.
Oh, she's strong. Okay.
Okay. I think we're ready to go.
All right, sweet.
So, Amy, what do you do?
Oh, I work at the Park Slope Food Co-op as a membership coordinator.
Oh.
Do you know? Are you a member?
No, I don't really get out my apartment that much, but...
So, what do you do?
Well, I used to work at an investment bank on Wall Street, but I lost my job, like, 6 months ago now.
6 months, that's a lot.
Yeah, it's a long time to be unemployed. You know, I'm very qualified, but when I went to actually start applying for jobs, I would just send cover letters and cover letters out and got no responses. I had this the wall of business, which is what I called it, of all of the jobs that I had applied to on post-it notes, and I'd put them all up. And I thought that, once I get interviews, I'd take them down, and then it would go from being the super covered wall and then bare wall. But I don't know if you saw when you were in my apartment, it's still covered in post-its.
But 6 months and not even an interview?
No, not even email responses. I was always checking, so I was just kind of always on the computer waiting to hear back. One day, I don't remember how I got there, but I ended up at JesusLovesYou.org, and it just really changed everything for me. I've got this chair, I've got some back problems, so it's one of those ones that you sort of kneel on and it like keeps your back supported. And I was just in that position and just on this website, and I just got down and I just really committed myself to Jesus.
I'm sorry. So what about Cola? Let's talk about Cola just for a sec. When did you get her?
Well, when I accepted Jesus into my heart, my old friends just kind of stopped understanding me. These people that I don't see that much, they've started sort of shying away from me online. And so this week's a good example. Even though I've kind of stopped seeing a lot of people in person, I'm still spending a lot of time on Facebook. And you know how it was doppelganger week this past week? And how everyone was putting pictures of their celebrity lookalikes on their Facebook profile. And I put up a picture of Jesus. And within about, I'd say, 5 hours, I'd lost, like, dozens and dozens of friends. Like, people just wiped me from their life. But, Amy, one thing I really know in my heart is that Jesus will never defriend me.
Okay. All right. Well, what about, when did you, well, it's back to Cola for a sec. When did you get Cola?
About 2 months ago.
Oh, she's, why do you name her Cola?
You know, when I accepted Jesus Christ into my heart, I knew I just really needed to commit and just give up things that were bad for me. You know, like soda, like pop, Cola.
Huh. Well, I'm on board. I really like Cola. I feel very comfortable with her, so.
I'm so glad she's going to have someone to take care of her in 3 weeks.
Three weeks?
Well, in 3 weeks, my unemployment runs out, and I won't be able to pay my rent, and I won't be able to buy food, and I know that Jesus would never let me suffer like that. So I've taken it as a sign that the rapture is coming in 3 weeks.
Huh. Well, I really like Cola. I feel very comfortable with her, so I think we're all set.
Well, Amy, I need to be sure of you. I need to make sure that you're not going to be coming with me.
I'm Jewish. I'm a Jew. I'm not welcome up there.
Well,
I hang out with gay people. And lesbians, too, and dykes.
Amy, I feel really weird about asking you to do this, but would you be okay with declaring allegiance to Satan?
Oh, man, that's kind of spooky. But, I just saw Legend with Tom Cruise. Did you see it? It's awesome. It's like, there's a unicorn and, like, the devil is in there. Tim Curry. He's a total devil. I mean, I would swear allegiance to him.
I don't know.
Well, I love cola, and I swear allegiance to Tim Curry, Satan.
If you lived in Manhattan up to 2005 when he passed away, you would often see these posters plastered everywhere for Shri Chinmoy, for his peace concerts. You know, they're free concert, and he's pictured on the poster with a wooden flute. And that's what got me to Central Park. I was approached by a few people in saris. I must have just been just smelling like a very impressionable, very likely recruit. I looked like someone who could be drawn into a cult easily. I was pretty fresh-faced. I had long dreadlocks. I wasn't always very clean. I think these are things that people can pick up on pretty quickly if, for people who want to recruit people in cults, the young and impressionable, and I was pretty young and impressionable, mostly impressed by the politics of the time. I went to a Ralph Nader rally, and so I definitely was looking for, you know, something. So they invited me back to come to their kind of group meeting back at Cooper Union, and so I went. And there was this, in the Great Hall of Cooper Union, there was a worldwide meeting of followers of Shri Chinmoy, and people were dressed in multicolored saris, each color for a different country, and they would go up to the stage and they would announce themselves in song. So the people from Bulgaria would say, Bulgaria, Bulgaria. And, you know, some of them just didn't seem to lend themselves to being sung. Canada. I didn't join this cult because it looked like it was going to be a little too much work to get into here. There was too many meditation classes. It was going to take the buying of a sari. I didn't really want to hang out with these people. The Unification Church is a church also known as the Moonies. It's leader, Reverend Sungyong Moon, is from North Korea. He escaped North Korea during the war and started a church in South Korea. His empire has grown since then. He has churches all over the world. There's a branch in Brooklyn, in Midwood, Brooklyn, on Avenue U, where I went and visited them. And it was just a kind of a single-family home, where services were upstairs and in the biggest bedroom. Kind of the interesting thing about the Unification Church is there's a lot of people are paired together personally by Reverend Sungyong Moon. Just he's a matchmaker of sorts. The church is all about family, about finding your true family, and so he takes people who are strangers to another and matches them together. So in this church in Brooklyn, you have a lot of couples where there's these, you know, diminutive South Korean women, short women, with these really tall, lanky American guys. And so you have a lot of these kind of awkward-looking couples. Nobody tried to set me up with any of the Moonies there. There weren't any single people. I imagine there's probably a, you know, singles club, an auxiliary club for singles. But I don't know exactly how that process happens. I didn't end up joining the Moonies, the Brooklyn Moonies. They didn't have a spark to them. These were people that seemed kind of tired. The Black Dog Cult was a cult led by Georgie Sirocco. Georgie Sirocco was a biofeedback practitioner. He had developed a cult of personality around him, and through his practice and his patients, he basically took his patients and brought them into his cult. He had developed this method of meditation where you would shake your head vigorously for hours, just back and forth, until, you know, if you were doing it properly, you would see him levitate, you would see lights, stars, you would, basically the truth would be revealed. And people would just shake their heads for hours in his apartment, just back and forth and back and forth. And on the one occasion where I had a chance to witness it, I was in his backyard, and his dog had recently passed away, and he had brought his followers around. This is why it was called the Black Dog Cult. He loved this dog. This dog was incredibly important to him. He didn't really have people on this earth that he trusted, that he really cared about. And so I guess it was all in this dog. And so he had buried it in the backyard, but I guess it had occurred to him that he could use this head-shaking method that he had developed to raise the dog from the dead, to bring the dog back to life. So we got in a circle around where he had unearthed the corpse, and the corpse was stinking. The flesh was kind of falling off of it. I mean, I had never seen a dead dog corpse in a state like this. And so we just were shaking our heads for hours, and like I was kind of scared. I don't know why I stayed. I don't know why. I guess I felt like I some way owed it to them to stay. It was very important to them. Eventually, George must have seen something. He must have taken something as a sign, or just trying to save face. And he pronounced that the dog had come back to life. He took it into his arms, and he brought it back into the house and locked the door. And that was the last I had seen that dog. I had no interest in joining this cult. So the only time I really thought about joining a cult was one time a few years ago. I was coming home from work from the school I was working at in the West Village, and I was coming home along the Hudson River bike path, right here where we're standing, and I was looking out on this pier, and there was these three boats parked out there, these beautiful boats made from shipping containers. You know, those kind of shipping containers that had the words Hanjin or China Shipping or Costco on them. Attached to the shipping containers were these wings from an old B-52 bomber and the tail off an old bomber and a propeller on the front. And the crew was just sitting out there on the wing, just eating barbecue and watching the sunset. For some reason, I was really bold, much bolder than I normally am. I went to this great West Village butcher that I go to often, and I got a bunch of sausage, and I came back to the pier, and I just started waving it over my head, yelling, "Hello, hello!" And they untied a skiff and came and picked me up. The rafts were really amazing. They had used a cutting torch to cut these rectangular windows in the sides, and if you looked up, there was this plexiglass dome with Concord grapes planted over the top of that, and inside there was a hydroponic garden. It was just beautiful. They were all in their mid-20s, like me. They called themselves the Bucket Brigade. And the names of the ships were the Sucket Bucket, the Red Bucket, and of course, the Hole in the Bucket. Each member of the crew was a combination of their first name and their bucket. And I met Kelly Bucket, Jamie Bucket, and Charlie Bucket. They had no satellite phone, no radar. They just had running lights, a pirate flag, and a CB radio. These guys just blew me away. So they were here on this pier in New York City making one last dumpstering run before they were going to float off towards Europe. I really liked Jamie Bucket, and as we were eating our sausages, she kept whispering to me that if I really wanted to, I could come with them.
But Charlie Bucket kept staring at me with this constipated look, and like he wanted to tell me something, but he couldn't. Eventually, Charlie Bucket took me aside and told me that, look, even though Jamie and I are in an open relationship, that I should really beat it. So he put me back in a skiff and took me back to the shore. I walked back to the West 4th Street station and I got on the A train, but by the time I got to J Street Borough Hall, I turned around. Screw Charlie Bucket. But when I got back to the pier, they were gone. The weird thing is, I can't find any trace of these guys on the internet. No Flickr page, no blog, no references in Google News. I mean, they don't exist as far as the internet goes. I hope eventually something will turn up.
When we look back at Obama's first year in office, one of the supposed failures is the inability to him to meet his self-imposed deadline of January 22nd of this year to close the prison at Guantanamo Bay. The story goes that no one wants to accept these prisoners. Like, there's this story, it's not in my backyard. We're not going to bring these prisoners here. They don't deserve a fair trial, and they'll put United States citizens at risk. So we don't want them. And then that's why Obama's not been able to move them from Guantanamo Bay. But the reality is just the opposite. Behind the scenes, there are several key players that are pushing as hard as they can to bring those prisoners to their states. The primary players here are Texas and California. So in Texas, you have Governor Rick Perry. His goal is to bring those prisoners to Texas where they can be put on trial and executed by him in the state of Texas. He thinks there'll be public appetite to convict and execute them, and this is going to be beneficial to him. The competing interest is California and Governor Schwarzenegger. Now, Schwarzenegger and Perry have a bit of a rivalry because they are the governors of two large states, and they are both Republicans, and they're kind of vying for the spotlight, in effect. Now, Schwarzenegger's got an even tougher uphill battle as far as capital punishment than Perry, because since 1976, there's only been 13 executions in California. Schwarzenegger sees 700 people on his death row currently, but he can't get the political support to get those people basically executed. So he believes the Guantanamo prisoners, if moved to California, will kind of break this logjam and give him more of that tough guy governor swagger that he had for a while. So he and Perry are both very interested in getting these prisoners moved to their states. So this is why the Obama administration is so focused on moving the prisoners to Illinois. There has not been a prisoner executed in Illinois since 1999. Back in 2000, then-Governor Ryan halted executions because he felt that the system was so flawed, and there has not really been an appetite to revive the executions in Illinois, and that's why Obama's interested in moving them there. One of the factors that's making the choice of Illinois easier is the fact that this is being viewed as a job creator. Senator Durbin, Governor Quinn, many other members of the Illinois delegation are pushing this because they say it will bring jobs to Illinois. There is one guy, though, that's causing some concern for the administration, and that is Representative Mark Kirk. He keeps saying, quote, "We aren't closing Gitmo, we're moving it to America's heartland," unquote. Now, most people are reading that as the typical "not in my backyard, it's too dangerous to bring prisoners here" kind of response. But in reality, the concern is that what Kirk's really saying is, bring the prisoners to Illinois and it's business as usual. Now, what I'm about to say is difficult to talk about and difficult for some people to hear. Back in 2005, three prisoners at Guantanamo Bay simultaneously committed suicide. The truth of the matter is that they were tortured to death by the guards at the camp. Now, this is the story that no one wants to talk about. And it is amazing that this was on the cover of this month's Harper's Magazine. On the night of June 9th, 2006, those three prisoners were removed from the main camp and taken outside the perimeter to a place called Camp No, where they were beaten, punched, kicked, walled, choked, and in the end, they had rags stuffed down their throats until they asphyxiated. Now, some are deeply concerned that business as usual in the heartland means these kinds of activities. Of course, the last thing that President Obama wants is for something like this to happen in Illinois. I know.
Is there any chance of something not horrible happening to these guys?
There is one possibility. President Obama has personally spoken to the Prime Minister of Canada, Stephen Harper, and floated the idea that the Guantanamo Bay prisoners be transferred to a facility just north of the Canadian border where we know they would be safe.
About new media conferences is that you get a free vacation. There was this one in Palm Springs a couple months ago that my company sent me to, and they were sending down six of us. Free vacation, six of us. And instead of us deciding to just go the boring hotel route, we decided to rent one of these amazing mid-century modern homes that Palm Springs is so famous for. You know, these bungalows, Eichler homes. And this one was over the top. So in a way, it was kind of like a private vacation for me and my friend Jessica. The other four people from the company just, you know, it was good that they came along because we were able to get this amazing house. But Jessica and I were just going to kill it at this conference. So the conference was called New Now Next, Emerging Media, Emerging Markets. They all have the dumbest names for these conferences. And it was 4 days long and it had all these speakers and panels. And it was about where new media was going, what we can do with it, and, you know, what's going to happen next. And most importantly, like, how are we going to make money at this? Because, like, people are doing all this really cool stuff, but you just, if there's no way to fund it, it's like, really, how far can advertising go? So, I mean, a lot of the talks were about this. I missed a lot of those. The thing about Jessica is that she's really, really smart, a great friend of mine, but she's a total klutz. Like, the first night we were there at the house, she trips over this glass coffee table and totally face plants on the fireplace mantle, rocking a black eye, first day of the conference. But the thing about Jessica is that she is so freaking hot that the black eye only made her, like, more interesting and kind of dangerous. And so she was just beating people like crazy. We had this plan.
You know, they always have these mixers every night, but screw that. We're going to bring people back and have dinner parties at our amazing place, pool party, boom, every night of the conference. So the black eye was kind of like our golden ticket. She kept, like, pulling thuggy IT design types, which is... It really is a subgenre. I don't know if, how much time you spend in the web design world, but they're out there. The last day of the conference came around, and I realized I really should hit a few more talks before it was all over. So I went to this one called Monetize This. Another hilarious name. And I was sitting next to this dude who was, you know, kind of fashionable and interesting. So I started talking to him, and he... name checks Dan Deacon in like 3 seconds. I'm like, what? Because I love Dan Deacon. Anyway, he turns out he's lives in SF too, and I'm like, dude, you totally have to come to our party tonight. And then I ask his name, and he tells me his name, and my jaw totally drops. His name is GUI, which is how you pronounce G-U-I. It's the acronym for Graphical User Interface. And yeah, it's sort of a weird name, but he is a rock star. He just goes, he's worked for every single technology company out here. He's worked for Google, eBay, MySpace, Dig, Facebook, Reddit, like, and he never works for any place more than maybe 8 months. He goes in there, he just like tears it up, and then another company calls him and he goes to the next place. I mean, he is the sh. So the party was great. It was just a really fun vibe. My roommates were super impressed I brought this guy. He was hilarious. It was just, he was kind of a, you know, the star of the party, but wasn't being a jerk about it. Just, it was smooth and lovely and hot. Then he, you know, he's like, hey, I'm gonna go get something. I'll be right back. And we're like, okay. So he goes back to his car and comes back with this small black suitcase, and he starts putting together this, sort of looks like tent poles, you know, because the all these like poles that fold in on themselves, you know. And it takes him about 10 minutes, and we look, and all of a sudden there's this enormous geodesic dome in this beautiful mid-century modern house we had rented. And on every single place where the poles intersected, there were these LED lights and like and these black discs. And there are all these wires coming off of the device and going straight into his computer. And like, what the heck is this? It was like Burning Man had just invaded our highly curated space. And he puts a chair in the middle of this dome, I guess for, you know, optimum light show viewing. And I'm like, oh, that's cute. You know, I was thinking that he was going to ask me to sit in the chair because we were really hitting it off. And he's like, Jessica, why don't you get in the chair? I'm like, what the... I was working this. She sits down and he's like, oh, Jessica, what's your Twitter name? So she tells him her Twitter name, and he types it in, and then the music starts and the lights begin. It gets really creepy. And about 10 seconds go by, and Jessica grabs her head and starts making this kind of weird sound. Hee, 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 like 4 times. And then kind of slouches down, and I'm like, cut it, cut it! Like, what the heck are you doing? So we turn on the lights, get her out of there, we're giving her water. Of course she's fine. And I look over, and there's all this stuff on his computer. Huge feed of words, just words, 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 scrolling all the way up. And I realize nothing is going to happen with this guy. He's into Jessica. This whole night is a wash. I got all excited for nothing. I'm like, dude, you gotta go. I kick him out. Done. Bye. We wake up the next morning. We're all super groggy and like trying to clean up this place so we can get our deposit back. And I'm helping Jessica out with the trash. We're, you know, picking it up. And I look at her, and her black eye was gone. She looks at herself in the mirror. She's kind of freaked out. I'm kind of freaked out, but we're like, black guy's gone. What's to worry? So we finished bagging up all our stuff, drive back to San Francisco. So a couple days later, we're all back in San Francisco, and I'm kind of thinking about him a little bit, and I decide I always just go for things, and it usually serves my purposes pretty well, so I just give him a call. And he actually answers and is really personable and is totally cool and asks me if I want to come over right now. And I'm like, right now? He's like, yeah, why don't you just come over right now? And I'm like, all right. And it turns out he lives about 4 blocks from me. So I get dressed, put on a little bit of an appropriate amount of makeup, and I walk over to Gooey's house. It was this huge raw space that was had all these incredible architectural details and beautiful furniture. One wall just had a cage of mice all on one side, and then there was like a workshop area that was basically a third of the whole warehouse space with just wires and soldering irons and chips and all this stuff going on. And in the middle of all of this is that dome that he brought to the party. And I go up and take another look at it. And he says, you know there's only 2 of these. I go, yeah? Where's the other one? At the Twitter office. I work for them now. And then he says, I am the one that is going to make Twitter rich. I'm the one that's going to show Twitter how to monetize. So what this geodesic dome is basically a huge orgone box, but it's not like mumbo jumbo sexual, you know, healing energy orgone. It actually works on tweets. He takes the live feed of every single tweet out there and beams them directly into your brain. And these tweets supposedly have super healing powers. And I look at him and I'm like, this is preposterous. But then I thought about Jessica's eye. I mean, it did clear up. Maybe that's why it was a Twitter feed that fixed her eye. I'm like, I'm getting in the chair. So I walk over.
Wait, why are you getting in the chair? What's wrong with you?
It's not important.
Yes, it is. You can't just say you're getting in the healing chair without saying what it is you need healed.
I'm not going to tell you.
Val, the story won't work if you don't say what it is.
I have something. It's super embarrassing. I don't feel like talking about it.
Just tell me what it is.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not.
I don't even know what to say.
It's not important. So
this
I walk over and get in the chair. And the lights, he turns off all the lights and he brings up the twitchy electronic music. And the lights on the dome start flashing. And I have that same reaction that Jessica does. I mean, I do the same, like, grab my head and I go, hey, hey, hey. And then it all kind of shuts down. He brings back the light, brings back up the lights, and he starts telling me about investing. And, you know, this is going to be the biggest thing. And, yeah, I can get it on the ground floor. And he's asking me how much money I have in the bank. And I'm like, I just want to go home and check out and see if it works and see if I'm actually healed. And so I leave.
Can I at least ask if it worked? Did you get healed?
No!
The problem was the painting, and so I've replaced it with a new one. Well, a new postcard reproduction. It's called View from a Window. It's also by John Singer Sargent. He painted it about 7 years after the one that used to sit in this gold-painted balsa wood frame. I have it right here in the studio with me, propped up next to the microphone. The painting depicts a view of a window, an artist window. The frilly lace curtain is pulled back and held in place by the artist paint box, and on the chair in front of the window rests an open portfolio. The paint box overflows with watercolors, pencils, and oils, and on the pages of the portfolio there are undefined swaths of color, light, and energy. The messy portfolio pages stand out in contrast with the tranquil view out the window. out the window, there is a harbor. And in the harbor, there are boats. Most of the boats are anchored and still, but a few are poised, ready to set sail. Most Sargent commentators don't know what to make of this painting. Most consider it just another oddity produced by the master after he stopped painting portraits of wealthy aristocrats and businessmen. But I consider this painting to be a masterpiece because it captures the idea that through art, man is able to transcend his surroundings. This painting is not an oddity. This is not a view of a window. This is an actual window. Here, let me move out of your way. Take a look for yourself. You'll find the view is breathtaking. I am determined to make it through this window. Before the boats have all left the harbor, I'm not sticking around. Besides, I'm not really a painter. I wouldn't know what to do with the watercolors or the oils. I can't really even draw, but I do know that there is a way to break the glass and crawl out over the windowsill. And don't worry, this time I won't be asking for your help. No, I am sick and tired of waiting around for something to happen or someone to help me. This time, I'm taking matters into my own hands. All I need from you is to step out of the way. You're snickering again. Well, go ahead, laugh. But I'll say it again. The reality on the other side of this window is just as real as the one we stand in now, perhaps even more real. But we don't have to go into that now. Like I said, all I need from you is to stand back. Thank you. So, on three. One, two, three.
This episode of Too Much Information is called Something Will Happen Soon. It was written and produced by Benjamin Walker, Bill Bowen, Laura Mayer, Amy Pearl, Noah Apple, Cindy Heller, Val Dorito, and Chris. For more information, visit the TMI show page at WFMU.org.
Join us at the same time next week for another edition of Too Much Information. You're listening to WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, WFMU.org. Up next, For the Record with Dave Emery.
Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 335, titled Walking the Snake, Part 2. This is being recorded on November 11th of the year 2001. This is more about the horrible events of September 11th, 2001, and the events that led up to it and are coming out of it. I've done a number of other programs on this subject, and due to the limitations of time, I won't be able to fill in all of the ancillary discussion. I want to mention at the top of the broadcast that the other programs either are already or will soon be available on Real Audio from sister station WFMU-FM in Jersey City, New Jersey. More recent programs are streaming at WFMU.org/Dave Emery, one word, DaveEmory. Older broadcasts, including the vast majority of the programs, are available for download only on Real Audio at a longer URL which is linked to the WFMU website. Beyond that, a tape and CD duplication service called Spitfire, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E, has all of these and other programs available on either CD or tape or CD-ROM. Their website is equipped with real audio. Look in the For the Record section at www.spitfirelist.com. And there are annotated descriptions of the For the Record programs that are available on the Spitfire website. Not all of them are up for all of the 911 programs, but they soon will be. Again, www.spitfirelist.com. Look in the For the Record section, and if the discussion goes too quickly, and it just might, the synoptic account with rigorous sourcing is available in the descriptions on the Spitfire website, and they are up through 3:30, I believe, as I record on November 11th. Now, to the subject material at hand. In past discussion of the 911 attacks, I have attributed this event, the authorship of it, to what I call the Underground Reich or the Remarkable and Deadly Bormann Organization, literally a Third Reich gone underground. I have stated my view that at the operational level behind the Islamic extremists are in fact Islamo-fascists, including elements that at the operational level are tied to the Underground Reich, and at the economic level are also tied to the Underground Reich, and I cite in that regard For the Record programs 327 and 331, dealing with, among other things, the stock market manipulation in connection with the 911 attacks. In For the Record program number 333, Forward into the Past, I discussed, among other things, the NPD, the top German neo-Nazi party, and one of its primary spokespersons, Horst Mahler, who endorsed the 911 attacks just as he had in a previous incarnation as an associate of the Bader-Meinhof gang, or Red Army faction, endorsed the Olympics massacre of September 5th of 1972, whose authorship also goes to what I call Underground Reich-linked Islamic extremists. In this program, the title of which comes from the Nazi tract Serpent's Walk that I've dealt with so many times in the past, we're going to look at some apparent connections between the operational Nazi-slash-Islamo-fascist elements and, among other things, the financial elements that may very well have been involved in the stock manipulation. We're going to take a look at hypothetical connections to the Bormann organization, and once again returning to the operational level, we're going to take a look at links between these milieu, plural, and American so-called neo-unquote Nazis, and elements that may very well be associated with the anthrax attacks in the United States. The title of the program is derived from the Nazi tract Serpent's Walk. I've spoken about that many times in the past. This book was authored by someone who uses the pen name of Randolph D. Calverhall, C-A-L-V-E-R-H-A-L-L. It's published in softcover by National Vanguard Books, copyright 1991. National Vanguard is the publishing arm of the National Alliance. It is the same Nazi publishing house that publishes the Turner Diaries, the apparent role model for the depredations of the Nazi terror group The Order in the 1980s, and also Timothy McVeigh and company in the Oklahoma City bombing. In this book, the Third Reich goes underground at the end of World War II. They build up an enormous capital organization. That is the flight capital organization that I've spoken about and referred to as the Bormann Organization, directed by the organizational genius Martin Bormann, the real power behind the throne of Adolf Hitler, so to speak, and someone who put together a formidable economic engine at the end of World War II. After going underground and building up their economic power, the Underground Reich buys into the American opinion-forming media, infiltrates the United States Army, and after a biological warfare attack on the United States and much of the rest of the world, which wipes out a considerable portion of the U.S. population, martial law is declared, they move in and take over the United States. That is the reference to Walk in the Snake, the title of the broadcast. It comes from the Nazi tract Serpent's Walk. Now, remember NPD, the top German Nazi party? Remember the Islamo-fascist elements I've spoken about? Hang on to your hats. Here we go. Financial Times of London, Friday, November 9th of the year 2001, has an article by Hugh Williamson and Philip Jacklin, J-A-K-L-I-N, in Berlin. Its headline, Far Right Has Ties with Islamic Extreme. It reads in part as follows. One of the people identified by the U.S. government as providing financial support to the Al-Qaeda terrorist network is also a well-known figure in the European far-right political movement. The link is likely to raise new concerns over ties between Islamic and right-wing extremists. Ahmed Huber, capital A-H-M-E-D, last name capital H-U-B-E-R, a 74-year-old Swiss businessman and former journalist who converted to Islam in the 1960s, is a board member of NADA Management, capital N-A-D-A, a financial services and consultancy company which is part of the International Al-Taqwa Group. The U.S. says this group has long acted as financial advisors to Al-Qaeda. Mr. Huber, who was based in Bern, is known in Switzerland and Germany as an Islamic fundamentalist who attempts to forge links to far-right and neo-Nazi movements. A spokesman for Germany's Office for the Protection of the Constitution, the Internal Intelligence Agency, said yesterday that Mr. Huber, quote, sees himself as a mediator between Islam and right-wing groups. He also belongs to the revisionist movement, which believes the Holocaust did not take place, the spokesman said. Klaus Beyer, spokesman for the NPD, one of Germany's main far-right political parties, said Mr. Huber has often addressed NPD events. Mr. Huber confirmed that he had contact with associates of Osama bin Laden at an Islamic conference in Beirut.